You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by the MLB.com Shop.
Hi, this is Phil Rogers, MLB.com Extras, NL Central Edition. Certainly, the St. Louis Cardinals busy with the big trade since we last talked, bringing in Jason Hayward and trading away, somewhat surprisingly, Shelby Miller. The Pittsburgh Pirates doing some good things, bringing in A.J. Burnett, bringing back A.J. Burnett. So the hot stove really cooking in the NL Central. Thanks for listening. As always, joined by Jen Langosch, Cardinals beat writer, who's been busy. We're early in the hot stove season, just wrapped up the general manager's meetings and heading toward the winter meetings. But it looks like the Cardinals got some of their major to-do list crossed off in acquiring Jason Hayward in a major trade with the Braves. Shelby Miller going the other way. Jen, obviously terrible circumstances opening the need to acquire an outfielder with the passing of Oscar Tabarez. Hayward, did you see a major move like that coming to replace him, or is it a little bit surprising?
No, it's not too surprising. I mean, it's been interesting over the last, I guess now it's been close to a month since Oscar's passing, but, one event really drastically has changed kind of the Cardinals' outlook on this offseason. And all of a sudden, as they started to project toward 2015, right field became a void for them. I mean, this is a team looking to hit more, looking for more offense. I mean, it's a club that, though it won 90 games last year, had a run differential of only plus 16. So they knew they needed to upgrade offensively, and they saw right field as that area. They also weren't opposed to going to a short-term fit, knowing that they have young Randall Grichuk and Steven Piscotty waiting in the wings potentially to take over long-term. So it was kind of a natural fit. And, early in the process, even general manager John Mozeliak noted that they would probably have to address that hole with a trade. The free agent market right now is thin in outfielders. The Cardinals had a surplus of starting pitching depth, so what they were able to do was to deal from that depth to fill that hole in right field. And in doing so, I mean, you look at adding Hayward into the lineup. I mean, the Cardinals' offense got significantly better. Obviously, his defensive pedigree is certainly substantial. But, this was the big move the Cardinals were looking to make, and they've made it before Thanksgiving.
And, Jim, I think you just touched on this, but I was going to ask about the contract situation. With Grichuk and also Steven Piscotty in the wings, do they just let this being the last year before free agency for Hayward, do they just let that play out and see where they are at the end of the year and, count on their depth if they do just have Hayward for 1 year?
I mean, I think they're going to let it play out to an extent, but Mozeliak was pretty clear yesterday in his press conference saying that they're interested in making Hayward a Cardinal for longer than 2015. I mean, certainly that's going to depend on a couple things. It's going to depend on how he performs this year as to whether or not the Cardinals want to make that investment. And it's also going to be dependent upon what Hayward can get elsewhere when he does test free agency after next year. The Cardinals hope is that they bring him here, that he enjoys playing in St. Louis like so many guys do. He enjoys playing in front of the fan base in the city, that he'll want to stay and make an effort to stay. You look at the Cardinals' outfield situation, and they certainly right now seem to have somewhat of a surplus of outfielders again when you consider Grichuk, Piscotty, you even have a Peter Borges kind of looming without a starting spot. But you also look at the situation Matt Holliday and his contract, the guaranteed part of it is going to be up in 2 years. So, if Hayward does lock on to stay here long-term, perhaps he becomes kind of the next Matt Holliday here in terms of staying for 6-7 years, and you still do have other outfield openings that are going to come for these younger outfielders coming up. So, definitely not a sure thing that this is going to be a one-and-done situation. That being said, the Cardinals also know that is a possibility. They were still okay giving up that sort of talent, even if it is just for 1 year of Jason Hayward.
Yeah, that's a great point, in my opinion, Jen, on Matt Holliday's contract has an option for the 2017 season. So if the Braves were to lock up Hayward, you'd only really be looking at an overlap in 2016 when you would necessarily have the two big guys there. And, so maybe that is something that they would be able to find the flexibility to do long-term. Looking at the other side of that trade, you know, there's got to be some sadness in Shelby Miller leaving the organization, given, you know, certainly the profile he brought, and, you know, a guy that only 23 last year, already said two years of 30 plus starts. However, you know, he kind of got passed by Michael Wacha, who people didn't necessarily see coming a couple years ago. You know, and even a guy like Lance Lynn has seemed to kind of outperform him. And I just wondered, obviously, still tons of potential, but Shelby Miller last year, fielding independent pitching, 4.54, and really just, you know, is all across the board, took a step back from 2013. What's your take on Shelby Miller at this point in his career? What are the Braves getting?
Yeah, I mean, we did see some growing pains from Shelby last year. You know, I think what was really encouraging for him was the way that he closed the season. I mean, he had a tremendous September, and, you know, that coincided with him, A, developing a sinker that he threw, you know, with more conviction, and B, starting to throw the curveball again. I mean, there was a point there where Shelby was a fastball pitcher, and, you know, teams sat on that fastball. They had some success, even if it was just fouling off pitches, and that's why we saw Shelby only lasting five, you know, maybe into the sixth inning. He wasn't able to pitch deep because that pitch count would get escalated so quickly. But, you know, as we saw him develop more pitches, he became a much more dynamic pitcher. And I think we have to remember, too, 24 years old, you know, two full seasons in the big leagues, a lot of promise. Again, with the development of those pitches, mentality-wise, very strong in that regard with the intangible side of things. Now, the Braves are getting a pitcher with a lot of upside. You know, you look at how much he's going to cost. I mean, he's going to essentially be making the major league minimum just over it next year and then enter his arbitration years. But, you know, the Braves do. They get a very good young pitcher that still has a lot to learn. But there's a reason he was a first-round pick and that he's been very highly touted throughout his climb in the Cardinal system. It hasn't all been smooth along the way. But this is a guy that I think would be valued by many organizations. You know, unfortunate for him, he was in an organization that is so rich in starting pitching that he did become expendable because, as you mentioned, they have a Lance Lynn, a Michael Wacha, obviously Adam Wainwright locked down. They have other young guys in the wings, and a Marco Gonzalez and Carlos Martinez. You know, they didn't have to have Miller to fill out their rotation. But I do think the Braves are getting a very good pitcher. I think he'll do well down there under a good pitching coach in Roger McDowell. And again, at 24 years old, I'd like to see where he goes in the next couple years.
And also in that trade, from Atlanta, they had a power reliever in Jordan Walton, which, you know, seemingly would push his Carlos Martinez into the rotation. And without clearing a spot in the rotation, there just wasn't room to do that. How much do you think the Cardinals internally, just for wanting to develop players, really felt the need to open a spot for Martinez?
Yeah, I mean, Jordan Walton is a very important piece of this trade, and certainly, you know, Jason Hayward and Shelby Miller are getting all the attention. But the Cardinals, I mean, their other point of emphasis this offseason was to improve the bullpen. You know, you look at Pat Neshek becoming a free agent, and there was no expectation that the Cardinals are going to re-sign him just because of what he's looking for in terms of both dollars and years, and it doesn't really fit here in St. Louis. So, you know, by acquiring Jordan Walton, he can become the Cardinals' setup guy, which, as you mentioned, gives the Cardinals the flexibility to move Carlos Martinez to the rotation. Now, that's not a certainty. You know, at this point, when you look at that fifth spot in the rotation, Carlos Martinez is a candidate. Marco Gonzalez is most definitely a candidate with what we saw of him and a little bit of starting in and out of the bullpen, particularly in October last year. He opened a lot of eyes. And there's also Jaime Garcia, and he's recovering from surgery, so there's some skepticism as to whether or not he'll be ready in spring training. But, you know, any of those three guys could come in and win that fifth starter job. I would say if you look at Martinez and Gonzalez, whichever those guys don't end up in the rotation – probably falls back into the bullpen, and then all of a sudden you have a strong seventh, eighth, and ninth with one of them, Walden, and then Rosenthal in the ninth inning. So, you know, the Cardinals bullpen did get better with this trade again. He was a very important piece to them and addressed another need that they saw coming into this offseason.
Yeah, and very minor move, or seemingly minor move. One of the guys I always find interesting when Dean Anna signed to a major league contract as a free agent after being taken off the Yankees 40-man roster, where he did get some big league time this year as a utility guy. He's a guy that I think sabermetricians, analysts like, who's sort of a late bloomer with a full skill set. And what do you think the Cardinals are expecting? I mean, obviously they need some infield depth behind Descalso or alongside Descalso. How would Dean Anna kind of figure in the mix at this point?
Yeah, I would say he comes in mostly as a depth guy. I mean, as we look at kind of the next couple weeks, you know, Daniel Descalso is a guy who's entering his second year of arbitration, and I think he's a strong candidate to be non-tendered for a couple of reasons. I mean, number one, his salary is going to escalate to a point. He's going to be making probably more than the Cardinals are willing to pay a utility infielder that doesn't get that much playing time. So if he does go elsewhere, you know, the Cardinals did kind of need to fortify themselves in the infield. You know, Dean Anna gives them an option. They still have Greg Garcia, Pete Cosma on the 40-man roster. Those guys can play across the infield. So, you know, it was just an area in the organization, both at the major league level and even, you know, at the AAA level, where they lacked a little bit of depth. So bring in another guy as an option. I don't think the Cardinals are necessarily done looking at utility infielders, so I wouldn't be surprised if they make another signing before the end of the offseason. It might not be a marquee name. I mean, last year we saw them go out and get Mark Ellis to fill a hole in the middle infield, so I would imagine if they do make another signing, it would be for someone that can play more than just one position, as Ellis could. But that is an area where the Cardinals felt they did need to fortify with some depth.
Well, as John Mozeliak said the other day, you know, you're never through trying to get better. And as the Cardinals head toward the winter meetings in St. Louis, they seem to have kind of taking care of the top of the to-do list, but it's going to be very interesting to see what other moves they make, and never rule out a big surprise. I know you won't go far without your cell phone, Jen. So thanks very much for being with us this week. As always, joined by Pittsburgh native and Pirates beat writer Tom Singer. And Tom, it's been an eventful week for the Pirates. Biggest news, and maybe a little surprising to some of us, the re-signing of A.J. Burnett. Did you see that thing coming, and how did that deal come together so quickly?
Actually, I did see it coming. It did come together very quickly. The day before they actually announced it, Neil Huntington told me that, yeah, they did have interest in bringing him back. At the time, I didn't write it because I figured it's something that was going to develop over time. But as you said, it you know, the next day it kind of landed, came together quickly. AJ had reached out to the Pirates that he was interested in coming back. I had told his agent not to negotiate with anybody else, and you know, bam, bam, 1, 2, 3, it came together literally overnight. Yeah.
Clearly, this is a guy that was enjoyed his experience pitching in Pittsburgh, and decided late in his career it's the spot to be, and worked out a deal, 1 year contract, $8.5 million to do it. What do you think he enjoyed the most with the Pirates? Clint Hurdle, the pitching coach, living downtown. What do you think it is about Pittsburgh that really grabbed the guy?
I really think he was it's a cliche, but, his personality is a perfect fit for the Pirates, and anybody who is familiar with the way AJ looks, I mean, he even looks like a Pirate, you know, from the old days with the tattoos and the facial hair, which, you know, maybe just a silly sideline, but basically, he was welcomed by the fans. It was a very genuine relationship. Certainly had a good working relationship with Hurdle and, Ray, the pitching coach. But I think more than anything, it was just the, you know, ambiance of the city, and he felt comfortable. And, when he came back with the Phillies, you know, he pitched once in Pittsburgh last year. It was an extremely emotional situation, and I think that kind of reconfirmed for him that if he was going to pitch one more season, he kind of went on record saying that this will be it for him. He just thought it'd be a comfortable place to do it. And he did want to go out with a winner. Obviously, the Pirates had him in the postseason the last couple of seasons. And, you know, he thinks that he's got a really good shot of, going into the dusk of his career with another playoff team. And that basically, that's kind of how it happened. And, you know, like you said, $8.5 million is slightly more than he was paid by the Pirates in 2013. The balance of his contract then was still being paid by the Yankees. So basically, it was a very, financially, it was a smart move from the team standpoint. And obviously, you know, AJ, kind of left after the 2013 season for a bigger payday in Philadelphia. That did not work out for him well on an artistic sense. So he just kind of came back to some place where he'd have a satisfying final season.
Hey, one last question on AJ. I mean, his last day in a Pirates uniform, not one that he especially enjoyed because the Pirates lost to the Cardinals in the division series 2013, and in that game five, he had been on track to start it, but Clint Hurdle opted to skip him and go with Gerrit Cole for that start. Was that something? How much do you think that stung his pride, and was that something that sort of had to get out of his system before he could come back?
Well, definitely. It's something that he had a pretty angry reaction to. It's pretty well known by now. I think it would have been a lot more difficult for him to deal with that had he somehow come back to the Pirates last season, because the memory of that was still fresh. But, by now, I mean, both Hurdle and AJ referenced it by saying that it's water under the bridge, and it really is. I mean, I don't think it was a significant thing that he had to move past before coming back to the Pirates, but it's really ancient history. And now, you know, he's at the situation where he probably recognizes that, he's no longer the ace of the staff. He'll very happily fill the, let's say, number two spot behind Gerrit Cole, who's now established. In 2013, he was a half-season rookie, which I think made it a lot more difficult for AJ to accept being bypassed. So, no, I don't think there's any the ramification from the leftover at all.
Okay, and in terms of where the Pirates are now with their rotation, they add one starter, but they still appear to be losing two in Liriano and Edinson Volquez. Definite need to go out and get one starter, or any feeling that they might have enough with the guys already on the roster?
Well, they still like to bring back one of those guys. Essentially, Burnett's return rules out the fact that they could compete for both Liriano and Volquez, but they'll still like to bring one of them back. We heard so much about the depth they've had in the minor leagues, so that may be put to a test. But right now, I would say the rotation definitely is still a work in progress. There's a lot of other made-do candidates out there, some veterans that they may be interested in picking up, something like Josh Johnson. I'm just kind of throwing that name out there as an example. They've had real good success with reclamation projects. But, I mean, right now you're looking at Cole, Burnett, a couple guys who last season were mid-season additions in Jeff Locke and Vance Worley. And beyond that, you've got some minor leaguers. Brandon Compton would be, the front runner. But I think they'd be definitely more comfortable with picking up one more veteran and then, filling out around them. You know, Burnett had such a strong relationship with Jeff Locke. So in that sense, Burnett's return may positively impact him as well. But I would say right now, it's still a work in progress for sure. They'll definitely want to go out and get another veteran. Either one of those guys, Liriano, Volquez, or somebody else.
And another development this week, not really a surprise given where the market went, but Russell Martin signing a five-year contract with the Blue Jays. Seemed like Neil Huntington got out in front of that at least a little bit by picking up Francisco Cervelli from the Yankees in a trade for Justin Wilson. Right now, Cervelli, Chris Stewart, two former Yankees. How do you think the Pirates are? How are the Pirates looking at their catching situation at this point?
I think they're pretty comfortable with it. Cervelli, oddly enough, defensively is supposed to be up in a tier with somebody like Russell Martin, who has the same assets. Good at framing pitchers. Basically, you've got two number ones. I think Cervelli and Stewart would pretty much split the catching duties. Neither one of them is going to catch 100 games. They'll be on the lookout for somebody else. I mean, Darwin Navarro, the Blue Jays catcher, certainly a pretty strong major league catcher. And he may be on the map as somebody that would still like to add. Catching overall is at a premium in the major leagues. If you can stockpile catchers, it puts you in a pretty good position to make additional moves to perhaps fill some other holes. So I wouldn't rule out the fact that they're still shopping for the third catcher, but I would think that'd be like a luxury. They don't need a third catcher for themselves, but if they do pick up somebody else, it would be to put themselves in a position to make a trickle-down move.
Taking a quick look at winter ball, Alan Hansen, the shortstop prospect, off to a good start in the Dominican Republic. And, clearly it seemed like Jordy Mercer kind of came on, nailed down the shortstop position. But a guy who's been versatile in the time he's there. How do you think Huntington and his staff is looking at Hansen at this point? And I know he was spent most of last year in Double-A. Probably still got development to do before they start talking about him for major league consideration.
Well, when you talk to major league scouts, oddly enough, they don't rate Hansen as highly as the Pirates themselves might. He's got a lot of chinks in his armor. I would think, they picked up a couple of journeyman, middle infielders to perhaps fill the role that Clint Barmas did last season. I would think Hansen might be a candidate to, usurp that role instead of the couple guys that they picked up, somebody like Justin Sellers from Cleveland. Mid-season, he may be somebody that you would call up. Hansen's played shortstop mainly in the minors, has a lot of defensive issues. I would think down the road that they may consider him as a replacement for Neil Walker. Neil is in a pretty precarious situation with the Pirates in the sense that he's going into arbitration for the third season and will probably come out of it with an $8 million contract. And as popular as Neil is in Pittsburgh, obviously being a local kid, he may eventually price himself out of the Pirates' budget. And at that point, Hansen may be the candidate to replace Walker. I'm kind of jumping way ahead here, but looking down the road, I would think Hansen's major league future may be more at second base than at short.
Well, Tom, thank you very much. Joined by Adam McKelvey, Brewers beat writer, and taking a look at a Brewers team that is probably more set than most going into the hot stove season. Doug Melvin at the GM meetings, talking to him, he said, we could play a game tomorrow. We've got six starting pitchers. We know who we're going to have at every position, just kind of making some fine-tuning moves. And one move they did make, though, Adam, picking up the son of former Braves general manager Frank Wren, outfielder Kyle Wren, who played in the fall league. What's your scouting report on the younger Wren?
Very good defensive center fielder, a lot of speed, and really an opportunistic pickup by the Brewers. They were a little reluctant when I talked to people from the club to get into this too much, but, they saw Frank Wren dismissed in September. His brother, a scout for the Braves, was dismissed. And I think the Brewers just put in a call to just gauge how the Braves felt about having the son of Frank Wren in their system and whether there might be, whether it might be a little uncomfortable and whether they might look at making a deal. And, weeks went by, they exchanged a bunch of names, and they were able to come to a deal. And for the Brewers, it's a guy who the scouting reports I see seem to indicate that this kid has a chance to play in the big leagues as a fourth outfielder, perhaps, maybe more. You never know with the player. But he's moved really fast in 2 years in the Braves system. and he has a chance to move fast for Milwaukee. Now, outfield is one area where the Brewers are actually pretty strong in that that farm system. Their number one prospect, according to us at MLB.com, is Tyrone Taylor, who's a true center fielder as well. They have some guys in the corners who are interesting, including Clint Coulter, a former first-round draft pick who just converted from catcher in the Arizona Fall League. So they've got some interesting names now in the outfield mix, and I think Frank Wren or Kyle Wren will definitely join that list and be among the Brewers, top 20 or so prospects.
Hey, sticking in that outfield, just looking at the roster and talking at the general manager's meeting, wondering if the Brewers could look at it like they have an outfielder to trade. I mean, certainly counting on Ryan Braun to come back from that surgery on his thumb strong to go along with Carlos Gomez. And now they have, in addition to Chris Davis, picked up Gerardo Parra at last year during the season. They strictly look at Davis and Parra as an outfield platoon, or along with having Logan Schaefer there too, could they possibly move an outfielder, say, to add an impact kind of a reliever?
Yeah, Phil, they could. The interesting thing about this Brewers team, and you alluded to it right off the top, is you can do that for this team at lots of different positions. Because as Doug Melvin said, we've basically got a team, and, minus the usual bullpen moves that every team makes every offseason, he's right. Their starting rotation is... it looks set with six, accomplished guys around the diamond. They've got a player at every position with the addition of Adam Lind to first base, and they could play a game tomorrow. The question is, and when Doug Melvin made those comments to you, most of the feedback I got when people responded to that was, would they be any good if they did that? And that, of course, is the most important question. It's one thing to have a team set. It's another to compete for the division, which this owner has made really clear he believes they should do in 2015. And where Doug Melvin is at now is he has this roster. He's not, as he was last year, facing a big hole at first base that he needs to fill. He doesn't, like many teams, have a big gaping hole in the starting rotation. So he's got the luxury of having his people come up with ideas. This is what they love to do. They sit in that war room during the winter and they brainstorm all sorts of ideas. Some of them are crazy and never go anywhere. And some of them lead to talks that you can sit down with another GM in the suite at the winter meetings and maybe you've got something. And I think the outfield is one place where most clearly they have the feasibility to make a move if you're just looking at 2015, because Gerardo Parra is arbitration eligible. He obviously can play if he's your everyday guy. He's proven he's a pretty good big league player. And, they've got the flexibility to make a deal right there. Now, whether they do it or not is another question. He is a free agent after next season. Chris Davis is a young power hitter that is at a premium now in baseball. See Giancarlo Stanton. And the Brewers would have to face the question of, if they make a move for 2015, how much would that cost them down the line? So, I think that it's a really interesting time to be working in the Brewers front office, and that you've got, on one hand, you've got a team set. On the other hand, you've got a completely blank canvas, and you can come up with a lot of different ideas to try to make this team better.
Yeah, I guess it comes down to, and I get the feedback of fans, Brewers fans frustrated and questioning the roster that they have. It comes down to, do you believe the team that was good for really most of 2014, or the team that collapsed at the end to wind up having a losing record in the second half of the season? And, going back and looking at the season, Adam, I was, I know the first half, second half record differential, but I was really struck by how much of that second half was just at the end, that losing 13 of 14 starting August 26th. And the feeling I get, it seemed like Mark Antanasio, the ownership, took a hard look at everything after that season was over. And when they made the decision to bring Ron Renicki back, not to make any major changes with the front office, it was kind of like buying into the team that was there going into August 26th and was positioned for the playoffs. And you know, just going to give those guys a mulligan and figure that things happen kind of in a random nature in baseball, and this team is going to be good enough to compete as put together. Is that kind of the same way you look at it?
That is probably a way to look at it, because if they had felt that there was something bigger going on, I think there would have been bigger changes than firing the hitting coach and the first base coach. So I think you're probably right about that. Another way to look at it is going into last season, Phil, you did the preview for the NL Central. Didn't you have the Brewers fourth at around 500?
Yeah, they were no question not unlike maybe the Royals in the American League. I mean, they were a surprise team, when they jumped up and were playing so well. And you look at the guys they were doing it with, they're pretty much established, proven players. It kind of made you think maybe we should have seen them coming a little bit. But I think this is a strong division, and unless you're the Cardinals, you're going to have a real chance to sneak up. But to your point, no question, I think they were an overachiever, a really surprise team for most of the season, yes.
So I view this sort of as maybe they were a team in the middle, and, they were not as good as they were early last year. They were not as bad as they were late last year. And if you kind of look at it that way and you look at the pieces that they do have in place, you can see why Doug Melvin and his staff would have some reason to believe next year could be better. You've got Giovanni Gallardo in a true contract year, Kyle Loesch in a contract year. Those two guys are at the top of your rotation. You've got Ryan Braun theoretically healthier after getting that thumb issue addressed surgically right after the season. He should be more productive than he was. You've got two key young offensive players in Scooter Gennett at second base and Chris Davis in left field, who will be in their second full major league season. And if you look at the track record of players, they're usually better in their second full season. One exception, their shortstop Gene Segura last year had a poor second season. They think he's a better offensive player than he showed last year, and he had the personal issues, heartbreak off the field. So he, they believe, could be a better player next season. And you start to add all those things up, and now you've got Jonathan Lucroy established as one of the top, potentially one of the top three catchers in baseball, at least in the National League. You've got Carlos Gomez established now as a real threat. There's reason to look and say, this offense should be better next season than it was in the second half, particularly of 2014, when they were one of the three lowest scoring teams in baseball. And I think that is kind of that's why they let the emotion get away a little bit. They took a couple of weeks after the season and then really had a hard analytical, emotion-free look at what happened. And I think they feel like there's reason for optimism, and that is why, so far at least, we haven't seen them break this team down and start over. They're rather going to add a couple of pieces here and there, first base being the biggest one, and try to compete again. But as you said, this is a really challenging division. The Cubs are coming on now. There are no easy teams in this league anymore, and that's why I think it is a fair question of Brewers fans to ask that fundamental question. Yes, you can play a team now, but is it any good? That still, to me, is a worthy debate.
Hey, let me throw one name at you, and then we'll hop off. But a guy that we haven't mentioned yet, that when I take a look at the Brewers, just sets up to me as a 2015 difference maker, or a guy that gets you over the top, and that's Matt Garza. In my head, he was a disappointing addition last year. Didn't do what he had been expected to do. But you break it down and you look at it, other than the fact that he did spend time on the disabled list and threw 163 innings instead of 200, the metrics are pretty good when he pitched. The 3.64 ERA is fine, and a very low whip, 1.18. If this guy could ever just get right and throw 200 innings, which, is certainly the risk the Brewers took on signing him. I mean, he hasn't had a 200-inning season since 2010. But if the season started tomorrow, he would be the guy that I would look at and say, here's the guy that can make a difference. You agree or disagree?
Yeah. Oh, totally agree with you, Phil, because I think he pitched exactly to the scouting report. When healthy and on the mound, electric. I can, off the top of my head, remember four or five games where you're starting to think no-hitter, and fifth inning, sixth inning rolls around, and he's working on a no-hitter. That's the type of pitcher he is when healthy. But, as you said, a stint on the disabled list, and that's become an annual, you know, a rite of the season for Matt Garza. I think you just sort of have to live with that for him, and if it doesn't happen, it's a bonus. And we're not talking about a guy who's not in shape, doesn't take care of himself. I mean, it's been fluky issues that have sidelined him in recent season. This year it was the oblique. That, I think there's plenty of evidence, and you look at other players who've dealt with this in the last 5-10 years, this is not a workout problem. This is just a fluky injury that happens to these guys now that they're more jacked up than they were in the 1950s when guys were coming to spring training out of shape. So, I don't know, Phil. I sort of feel like if you get 175 innings out of Matt Garza, that might be about right. And there are 175 really good innings, and you're right to say the metrics love him. There was a case for him to really be the Brewers pitcher of the year if you go just based on some of the metrics. And then you hope that you have solid guys in those other positions to pick things up when and if he goes down. In last season, the Brewers actually did so. They brought in Mike Fiers, who was outstanding again for the Brewers. That's not the reason that they fell off in the second half that Matt Garza got hurt. It was really an offensive problem. So if the Brewers have some depth in starting pitching, which they feel like they do, they should be able to overcome the fact that Garza is going to miss some starts, and you hope that that time is just relatively brief.
Well, Adam, thanks very much. We're heading toward the winter meetings, and I know the Brewers still looking to add some something to the bullpen, maybe the veterans start some starting pitching depth somewhere. Maybe if it's a minor league signing, guys that they could go from being six deep with starting pitchers to where they could say they're 7 or 8 deep before spring training rolls around. So still some things to do, even though they say this team is set. Thanks very much for joining us, Adam. Today we've got a pinch hitter, Reds broadcaster Jim Kelch filling in for Mark Sheldon, Reds beat writer. Jim, thanks very much for interrupting your off season for us.
No problem at all. It's always good to be mentioned in the same breath as the great Mark Sheldon.
Oh, I'm sure it is, especially at dinner time. Hey, one thing I know is a done deal, though, Jeff, is another move, adding experience with a longtime National League manager, Jim Riggleman, joining Brian Price's staff as the third base coach. Jim has some pretty good background with Reds minor leaguers too, right?
Yeah, the last 3 years he has worked in the Reds minor league organization as a manager. 3 years ago he was down at AA Pensacola, the last 2 years with the top minor league guys at Louisville, so he knows the system. He knows the strengths of some of these guys that could have some time in Cincinnati this year, and it's always good to have a guy like Riggleman, who's been a third base coach in the big leagues before, and then people say, well, it's been a long time ago, but keep in mind that when you're managing in the minor leagues, 99% of the time you are also coaching third base, so you've not only got to manage but also coach the base, so it's not like something he's going to be jumping into something that he hasn't been busy doing for the last couple of years. And in terms of a baseball mind, I mean, this guy's managed 4 spots in the big leagues, so I think he'll bring a perspective to the Reds that they may not have had last year. And, you know, Steve Smith, who was the coach there last year, took a lot of heat, some warranted maybe, some unwarranted, regarding the number of runners he had thrown out at the plate. And when he was let go, he kind of intimated that maybe he was a scapegoat. But the fact is that Riggleman will come in, and I think that he'll do a very good job with this team.
Well, it looks like there are a couple good progress reports on key Reds players in the last week, with Joey Votto coming back on his rehab from that distal strain of his left quad, and Homer Bailey from his flexor surgery. So just good news there, all sides continuing to point in the right direction with those two guys, obviously key guys. There were some reports that the Reds were kind of kicking the tires on Michael Kadire before he signed with the New York Mets, and obviously that's the one real roster spot that I think people who follow the Reds are waiting to see what they do in left field. Have you heard anything about just kind of that activity around trying to, whether it's through a trade or if it's signing a free agent, bringing in a left fielder, still maybe a free agent like Nori Aoki or kind of a leadoff guy? Or what do you think would be the ideal solution there?
Well, an ideal solution would be a guy that you could get for 1, maybe 2 years at a decent price, meaning probably somewhere near but under $10 million a year. And with Jesse Winker in the offing and Yorman Rodriguez, a guy who had some big league time at the end of last year, hopefully a year or less away from being ready to play on an everyday basis, you don't really want to tie up anyone certainly longer in 2 years, and I have heard that Aoki is trying to entertain the thought of a 3-year deal, so he may or may not be someone that could fit in with Cincinnati. I've been intrigued, Phil, by the talk of Torii Hunter, and he's 39 years old, but this guy put up, again, very good numbers last year, and he certainly would be in a position that, as I say, 39, going to be 40, in a position where the longest he's going to be offered, I would guess, would be a 2-year contract and maybe even a 1-year. This guy would be a clubhouse presence that, by all indications, the Reds may need a strong presence like that in there. And the numbers he's put up, I could see him doing very well at Great American Ballpark. So I wouldn't be opposed even to a Torii Hunter.
No, that would be an excellent solution. Take as strong as Bruce is defensively in right field, put a Torii Hunter next to Mr. Hamilton there in center field, and that would be quite a defensive outfield to start off. And yeah, I'm with you. He could. He's still going to run into 20 plus home runs, I think, and be a really nice presence. That's a good name, Jim.
Well, there have been some other names that have been thrown out also of a lesser value, and that would be a guy like a Johnny Gomes, who used to be here in Cincinnati, not an everyday guy, certainly. Chris D'Onofrio, who's had some good years, another former Red, although his numbers down were a little bit down last year. And even I've seen the name of Emilio Bonifacio thrown around, and I know that Bonifacio seems to be injury-prone, but, boy, every time he's played against the Reds, he seems to do well. So, you know, you've got that level, then you take a level up with Hunter, and you take a level up with Michael Morris, so it'll be interesting to see. I even have read some things about the possibility of a trade for Justin Upton. Not opposed to a Justin Upton, although his salary is closing in on $15 million, but I certainly wouldn't be interested in Upton in trading Johnny Cueto away for him, which is what I've been reading about.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like whoever it is as up against it as the Reds seem to be with all of the guaranteed money and the arbitration guys. You know, if they do bring in a big-name guy in left field, you know, maybe it does cost them one of those starting pitchers that's a year away from free agency and starting to push. Although I'm with you, I think with Cueto, you got to go to do everything you can to get him signed to an extension, I would think, before you consider moving him. Wondering, backing up a little bit, Jesse Winker, he's a guy that's been on the radar a while in Cincinnati. He was a minor league hitter of the year for the organization in 2013, and then is coming off an Arizona Fall League where he not only hit for average, but he hit for some power too, was productive, 3 home runs, 18 RBIs in 19 games. And talking to scouts, this was not a typical year for the Fall League in that there was a higher level of pitching, and the offensive numbers were down, yet this guy was productive. I know he spent most of last year in Class A and isn't somebody people should start thinking is going to arrive early next season, but just how do you see him? Do you see him more as a high average guy or more as a guy that's going to hit for some power, some gap power, and maybe be a middle-of-the-order type hitter?
You know, Jesse Winker kind of came on our radar here about a year ago now after having that year in Dayton in 2013 where he did do so well and, as you said, was named the hitter of the year in the Reds organization. We got to know him via the Winter Caravan, and then he went out to the Cal League last year and has absolutely tore it up out there. reiterating the fact that this guy was a very good hitter. The question you throw out there is, do we see him down the road as being more of an average guy or more of a power guy? And I would look at him and maybe equate him to Todd Frazier in terms of how he developed his power really after he got to the big leagues. You look at the minor league home run numbers of Frazier, and they really weren't there. But he's become a better hitter in the big leagues in terms of power. And I think Winker could possibly be that guy as he gets a little bit bigger, gets a little stronger. He's a very fine outfielder. He's hit for average, and I think he'll continue to do so. But, boy, this guy's just he loves the game of baseball. He's rising fast. He's probably one of the few guys in the Arizona Fall League that wished the season would have continued because of the second half that he didn't have because of the wrist injury. He didn't get to play much. But I'm really, really looking forward to seeing him in spring training and then where he starts in 14, and I guess in particular where he ends, I should say 15, and where he ends in 15. It would not surprise me at all to see him wearing a red uniform in the second half of next year.
And one last thing, Jim. I know we spend most of our time talking about the big-ticket players, and I think the fans do too, but baseball is about all sorts of players and deep rosters. And the Reds had a guy, one of my favorite guys who's come through Chicago the last 10 years, Dylan Axelrod, came up, pitched well in the little chance he had last year, and I see he's pitching well in winter ball in the Dominican Republic. And just kind of wondering, just strictly a depth guy for the organization, or, you know, he's got more swing and miss. You know, people kind of look at him as a just a journeyman type guy, but I've seen him have some real games where he gets a lot of movement on the pitches and a lot of swing and miss. Could he be a late bloomer sleeper, or is he just a guy I like?
Well, actually, Phil, I kind of liked him at the end of the year last year also because he came over and made two or three very impressive starts, one of which was out in Colorado, if I recall, and had a little injury late in the year, costing him probably two starts that he would have been given. But, you know, I thought he did a nice job, and I would say right now, just in looking at things, that he is probably a depth guy, an insurance guy to start the year. However, if you go ahead and make a trade or two with one of your pitchers, he all of a sudden could become the possibility of a fifth starter. You know, there were guys like Axelrod, Daniel Corsino, David Holmberg late in the year, all made starts, all made some impressive starts. And so if you need to trade to get what you need out in left field or wherever else, possibly the bullpen, maybe one of these guys all of a sudden steps up. The Cardinals said that they made that trade recently out of an area of depth in their organization, starting pitching. I would say the Reds are probably in that same situation.
Well, Jim, thank you very much for filling in for Mark Shelton. It's been Jim Kelch, joined as usual by Kerry Muscat, Cubs beat reporter. And things are never dull around the old Northside team. Some major activity on the free agent front, but before getting into any of those endeavors, a very interesting and somewhat curious trades last weekend coming out of a general manager's meeting, acquired second baseman Tommy La Stella from the Braves for Aroldis Vizcaino. Most of the time Vizcaino spent with the Cubs. He was recovering from Tommy John surgery, got back on the mound last year, but I think La Stella is the intriguing part of this, obviously. Carry an on-base guy, but a guy that's played nothing but second base his whole career with the Cubs' heavy inventory of middle infielders. What do you make of this pickup?
I think the reason they did it, at least according to General Manager Jed Hoyer, is that La Stella has the qualities that they are looking for in players, you know, guys who get on base, guys who are good contact hitters. He doesn't have any power. I think he had one home run last year off of Strasburg, which isn't bad, but still, we're not going to count on him for 20 home runs. But he's the type of hitter that might fit well at the top of the order. I think they're also looking at him. You know, people might say, well, they already have, you know, Baez and Castro. They have plenty of infielders. I think the situation here is that they don't necessarily need La Stella on opening day. If you're putting the roster together here in November, they can kind of give him some time to get on track. He did really well his first 40-something games and then didn't do so well the last 40-something games. So they could give him some time. They're kind of looking at him as like a Chris Coughlin. That would be a comparable, you know, somebody who maybe started in the minors and then became a key factor down the road with the team. You know, they acquired Coughlin last year. Nobody knew where he was going to fit, and he became just a really key part for their outfield. So I guess LaStella's an interesting piece. Hoyer, you know, insisted that this is somebody that they've had their eye on for a long time and that we shouldn't read anything more into this, that it's not, I think the word was precursor to some other move, because I think on social media it exploded that they're going to be trading Baez and trading Castro, and that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, I the big picture, I don't buy into the wave of people thinking that the Cubs now are getting ready to pull off a big trade just because they have this inventory of position player prospects. I mean, you know, I think if the right deal comes along in the next year, year and a half, they'll certainly be able to trade young hitting for pitching, but, you know, that they would necessarily be looking to go out and make that big move right now doesn't, you know, based on the people I talk to, the people you talk to, that's certainly not what we're hearing. Could La Stella beat out Javier Baez for the second base job next spring, assuming they're both there? I mean, the Cubs have said Baez is the guy, even though he had crazy high strikeout totals this year. Could he be a guy to somewhat push Baez in spring training?
Possibly, but Javi played really well at second base. I think we've talked about this before, with Javi's track record, he's always had a slow start at each level. So what they're hoping is that after having the experience at the big league level in 2014, that will help him in 2015, and he'll know what he has to work on and get better. I think Baez is a better defender at second, even though he's a true shortstop, but I think he's a better defensive player at second base than La Stella. And I've also heard where they may have La Stella play a little third base this spring to get familiar there so that they could use him more. He could be a really key guy off the bench. My understanding, and I don't know Joe Maddon's style that well yet, but my understanding is he likes to use a lot of players, and if he can, you know, maybe make a switch later in the game, put La Stella in there someplace, maybe that's the way they go.
Yeah, looking at La Stella, though, you know, in the minors, he's actually his whole pro career, last four seasons, never played any place but second base. That doesn't
right.
mean you can't, but he hasn't. And you know, his minor league OPS, .881, really good. I mean, that's just really a tick below the level of all of the Cubs, Jorge Soler's and all these guys. I mean, I think La Stella's a really intriguing player. Just me personally, I'll be intrigued to see what they do with him going forward. But the Cubs, on the day we're taping this, I believe John Lester may be in town or coming to town, and we've got the Hawk, the winner has come before Thanksgiving. I hope they bring in a nice heavy coat with them to the airport. But before getting on to Lester, Russell Martin, Cubs made a very strong push to sign him, identified him as a difference maker, not just behind the plate, but with leadership in the clubhouse. But as we knew they would, they had a choking point in the talks and got outbid by the Blue Jays, who went 5 years and $82 million to keep him. Where do you think that leaves the Cubs in terms of the catching situation, Kerry? My own opinion, Wellington Castillo, you could upgrade, but pretty decent catcher they already have. Do you think they look at that as a position they need to improve, or was it just Martin's availability that kind of triggered it?
It could be a little of both. I know they were really disappointed in Welly because he did so well in the second half of 2013 and wasn't able to carry that over. You know, he had 274 in 2013, and then he only hit 237 last year. And he tends to have just little nagging injuries that slow him down, which has also been a problem. Defensively, he's really improved. And so if you can pick up, my feeling is that a catcher number one should be a catcher, and that's his main emphasis. And if you get the home runs, if you get the average, then that's a real bonus. I think Castillo has really improved in his pitch calling and his defensive abilities. I think he's much better. They could use an upgrade, but I just think he's much better than maybe, you know, it's not like they were horrible at catcher, that type of thing. So they got outbid. I mean, kudos to the Blue Jays. I think they got a great guy. And the other thing, you know, they're an American League team. They can offer Martin the chance to DH a couple days, so he won't have to be behind the plate as much. That will obviously prolong his career. So it seems like a good fit there. I guess I'm not crushed. I wouldn't expect the Cubs to spend that kind of money on a guy who's 30-something years old, especially when they have a kid like Kyle Schwarber in the system. I mean, they're so high on Schwarber and the progress that he's made. You'd hate to have somebody sign for that long term and then kind of block Schwarber coming up.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you could have gotten Martin on a 3-year contract, maybe a 4-year contract, you could say, okay, this buys Schwarber time to develop. We don't have to rush him. And left-handed hitter, right-handed hitter, we can get them both at bats when Schwarber's ready, and then maybe possibly trade Martin for the fourth year of Schwarber's develop. But 5 years, I agree with you, that would be sort of a deal breaker on that. And now moving on to the main event of free agency, going out to try to land a number one starter. The Cubs in very heavily on John Lester, Kerry, but how do you gauge their interest in the other top free agent starters that are on the market, Max Scherzer, and to a lesser degree, James Shields? Do you think it's Lester or bust? Or do you think their interest could shift from Lester to one of the other guys, as the process plays out?
Well, that you're right that they're bringing Lester in on probably one of the worst days in Chicago in terms of single digits, and there's a nasty wind chill, and so hopefully they've got the car warmed up and a nice coat for him, so it's a pleasant day. I don't know. I haven't heard as much talk about Scherzer and Shields. What they could do, let's say they don't get Lester, what they could do is they could angle more towards somebody like a Jason Hamill and bring him back, and then, take their chances that way. I think Theo has taken the attitude that they don't. This is not a 2015 is not a make or break season for them in terms of, you know, they're missing that one piece that's going to get them to the World Series. 2015 is still another year of development, and they're going to have a lot of young players on the roster. They're going to have a lot of guys that it's just still going to take some time with these kids. And so if they don't get Lester, I'm sure they'd be disappointed, but I also think that they could fill in with a guy like a Jason Hamill, who really worked well with Chris Bosio, the pitching coach, when he was there before. They could fill in with, you know, maybe they could go and pursue again the Cole Hamill talks, you know, with the Phillies, or go some other route and fill in the rotation that way.
Kerry, thank you very much. For Kerry Muscat, this has been Phil Rogers. This is MLB.com Extras.
Visit the official online shop of Major League Baseball at MLB.com/shop for the largest selection of authentic caps, T-shirts, jerseys, hoodies, collectibles, and more. Get your gear straight from the source, the MLB.com shop.